Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Paul Kian, one of your hosts, and with me, as always, is my co-host and Bat cousin, Sean M. Myers. What's new, Sean?
Hey, Paul. I'm happy to let you know that Bat Uncle Danny is here, and he brought subs for us to eat. Subs, hoagies, grinders, or Dagwoods. I love them all.
Well, I'm doing okay too, Sean, but I still can't understand a word of what Bat Great Uncle Tom says. It always sounds like he's trying to say,
I will break you.
Anyway, this month we're helped to welcome back our friend and a friend of the Fire and Water Network, not to mention a t-shirt entrepreneur and a great tutor on how to use credit card machines, Brett Young. How's it going, Brett?
Hi, Bat Cousins. Great to be back at the reunion. It is a beautiful fall day, but I realized that this will come out in December, so I wanted to kind of lean into the holidays a little bit. So I brought those peanut butter cookies with the Hershey Kisses on top.
Yes.
Fabulous. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring a cocktail as well. So again, leading into the holiday tradition, this is my recipe for Etrigan eggnog. Now, this is the recipe per glass, because I'm not making a big punch bowl of this. That's disgusting. So first of all, you buy some eggnog, because nobody wants to make that stuff from scratch. You don't have to do that. Don't waste your time. Get some rocks glasses. In a rocks glass, you want to do a half Batman shot glass of dark rum, a half Batman shot glass of whiskey, a full Batman shot glass of Bailey's Irish Cream. Then you put in the eggnog, stir. If you want to go crazy, you can blend this up in a blender, add a little ice so it's a little more like almost like a smoothie. Top it with a little bit of nutmeg and enjoy. Yeah, that's the recipe for today.
Now, in terms of eggnog, do you have any particular brand, perhaps a Turkey Hill?
Oh,
eggnog?
Absolutely Turkey Hill. Absolutely Turkey Hill. I should have said that. But no question about it. Turkey Hill eggnog is the best.
Well, we're glad to have you back, Brett. You know, it hasn't been that long, only 5 months since you first appeared on episode 19. So we've already heard about your history with the Batman family.
Right.
But since then, we were fortunate enough, listeners, to meet up with Brett at the Baltimore Comic Con, had lunch with him. And you told us that if you were on another episode, you want it to be this one. Can you tell us why?
Wait, I have to interrupt. We don't let just anyone on here to shill their real estate ventures.
Oh, all right. Well, let me scratch off some notes here. Let me scroll down a few pages. Basically, when you guys were talking about having me on again, I looked through on DC Ultra Humanite Universe and looked at the Detective Comics episodes to see which one. And I saw, oh, I have that one. Let me do that one. That's my amazing story on that. But what I did want to talk about, that it was great meeting up with you guys.
Yeah, we had a great time.
For listeners, it was myself. It was Paul, Sean, Paul's brother-in-law, Todd, and some other guy who just wouldn't stop talking the whole time at lunch. I forget his name. Rob, I think it was. But anyway, he was a little too cool to join us at the Comic-Con itself. But so he left. But we went in. It was my first comic book convention, believe it or not. And you guys were really helpful kind of walking me through it. Paul basically walks in there and is being greeted like he's Don Fanucci from The Godfather 2. You know what I mean? I was waiting for some like street vendor to come up and give him an apple and kiss his hand.
I live in Baltimore and Paul knew more people there than I did.
That was pretty cool. And you had a whole truckload of stuff you were handing off.
Yeah, I sent some books to be auctioned off because I'm sort of liquidating some things out of my collection. And as a trial, because I hadn't done the third party auctions before, I do sell stuff online. But yeah, and it went pretty well. So I'll probably do more.
Cool. Oh, good, good. I'm glad it went well. So Sean was great. He showed me around a lot. I got to meet the great Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
And it was great. Sean kind of stood by me like when I take my kids to see Santa. Sean kind of stood to the side and like took some pictures and everything. So that was really nice. I really appreciate you doing that, actually. It was really cool to meet him. Unfortunately, a lot of the guys that I really looked up to growing up have passed. And he's one of my all-time favorites that's still with us. I don't know if he understood a word I was saying. He signed a couple comics for me, DC Comics Presents. And one thing I didn't even realize that he was looking at me funny about was he did the interior for the Green Arrow Superman issue, which I think was DC Comics 20, but he didn't do the cover. The cover was a Ross Andrew cover. So he's sort of looking at the cover like, wait, you want me to do that? Then he kind of looked inside and he's like, okay. So that was really nice. And the other thing, Sean was aghast, brought a issue of the Defenders that Kevin Maguire had drawn, and I wanted to get that signed. And we went by his table and there was like four people in line. And I was like, nah, I'm not waiting. And so I was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm at that point where I don't, unless I absolutely have to, I will not wait in line for anything. So, but we went back and there was just one guy there. So I did get it signed. So that was nice. And then there was the Moon Knight incident, which we won't speak about. So that really just, you know, remember kids, hold a grudge. I had a great time. That was a lot of fun. Hopefully we can do it again next year in Baltimore. It was fun. And Sean learned how to use a credit card machine, hopefully.
That's awesome. Well, thanks for the con recap there, Brett.
Exactly. Yeah. There you go.
So Sean, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is actually all about?
Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even The Tales of Gotham City and Black Lightning. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. Now we're going to get into Detective Comics number 484, starring the Batman family.
All right. So this issue was cover dated June and July 1979 and went on sale March 8th of 1979. It's 64 pages, no ads, six all new thrillers, as it proclaims on the cover. But we have an important thing going on here. We have a logo change. So we have unfortunately lost our Batman family logo. It's now Batman starring in Detective Comics. It's the logo with Batman's cowl and head looking sideways with the cape encircling the whole logo. But it does say in the Dollar Comics thing at the top, featuring the entire Batman family. The front cover is by Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano, with a back cover pinup by Jim Aparo. So let's talk about the front cover first. Brett, do you want to describe what's on there and give us your thoughts?
Yeah, the front cover is nice. I like Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano, his depiction of the scene from the Batgirl story. It kind of looked like it was originally drawn to be a full cover image, and then they sort of cropped it a bit, especially on the right, because the way sort of Batman's half cut off there. The big block of white on the left kind of takes away from it, makes it a little bland. But overall, I like the image itself. It's a really good depiction of Commissioner Gordon. I think Andrew really nails him, and Batgirl.
All right. How about you, Sean? What are your thoughts?
It's one of my infamous boxed covers, and this is exactly why I hate what I call boxed covers. I think that image of Batgirl standing over her father, I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Probably one third of the cover, the top cover, is almost all logo and trade dress. Yep. So I understand that you're kind of stuck with that. I still think they could have made it work a little bit better by not having the brown background. I'm going to bring up the fact that I absolutely hate and despise and need to use a thesaurus to look up 1,000 more words of how much I detest this logo. For the life of me, we joke, but it's true, that Batman Family rescued Detective Comics. That is absolutely true. Batman Family was selling more than Detective. Yep. So I don't know why the Detective Comics logo is so huge. I think Batman, the character, is represented better in the Batman Family logo than he is here in the Detective Comics logo.
I wish I had asked Paul that, because he took over as editor when I went to Detective, and he's seeing Detective Comics as an anthology comic the way it used to be way back when it first came out, which is great, which is fine. You're going to get Batman, Robin, and Batgirl in every issue, but after that, he's much more open to sort of whatever, as we'll begin to see in the next, yeah, you know, dozen issues, the remaining dozen issues. I don't know why, from a sales perspective, that was deemed, Sean, to be better, but I agree with you. I mean, we're partial. We love the Batman Family logo, and I don't detest this logo, but I don't think it's as strong as some of the other logos, but it is what it is. But in terms of the image, clearly on model, Ross Andrew, not that long that he's come over from Marvel. I mean, he just had a long stint on Spider-Man. He's just come over and started doing work for DC, and he becomes one of their primary cover artists. Guy knows what he's doing. He drew the Superman versus Spider-Man. Batgirl, Commissioner Gordon look great. His Robin looks a little out of proportion to me. He looks a little strange coming in the window like that. Sort of got squeezed in, it looks like. But overall, you know, it's a catching cover in terms of the subject matter, but it is very busy.
Counterpoint, I actually like the logo. Yeah, I think it's like Batman's giving it a big hug. You know, I kind of like the...
Thank you for listening to the shortest episode ever of Batman Family. Next month in 485, we'll have...
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, before we get any more arguments, let's move on to the back cover. Brett, you want to give us a description of this by Jim Aparo?
Well, the back cover is where it's at. I absolutely love this Rogues Gallery picture of them all getting together for a drink and buying a full can of paint to cross off an X on Batman's headshot there. I think that's fantastic. It's a wonderful image. I'm not one of those guys who kind of worships at the altar of Jim Aparo. I like his stuff fine, but this particular image I think is great. And it kind of reminds me a little of the JLI style covers, the whole want to make something of it.
Covers. Yeah, they're looking down though, instead of looking
up.
Yeah, they're looking down,
but yeah, it's exactly from that kind of overhead shot.
Do you know why they're drinking champagne? That's the only thing I don't know. Like,
well, I have a point about that.
You have a theory about that?
One thing, no, it's more of a nitpick. That's not a champagne bottle. Clearly, it's got to be a whiskey bottle or something like that.
Well, okay.
Just to be kind of a snob about this, champagne bottles usually have kind of a long, slender neck and a wider bottom.
Okay.
And just as a tip from a former bartender, if you're going to drink champagne or any sparkling wine, don't drink it from coupes. That's the type of glasses they're using. You want more of a flute or a white wine glass, because the narrow flute, it helps the sparkling wine retain its effervescence for a longer period of time. The coupe glass, because it's so wide, you have a rapid loss of the bubbles and it's going to go flatter quicker.
Wow.
Just so you know. So
picking up some knowledge here.
Not to throw any shade on the late Mr. Aparo, but that's not a champagne bottle. And put it in nicer glasses, Jim.
Sean, any thoughts before we move on?
I love stuff like this. I definitely like this more than that Batcave back cover from last.
Oh,
I love this one much more than that one. I don't know that I really have anything to say. I agree with Aparo. There's stuff of his that I think is great. The Treasury cover with the bat signals, I think that is fantastic. I think this is great. And one thing, the red X reminds me of JLA 195 with Secret Society, where they have the 10 of them with the red X's. But yeah, everybody looks great. I mean, it is the top tier Rogues Gallery.
Do you think Ra's al Ghul's a little annoyed that he's in the back? He doesn't strike me as a guy who wants to be in the back. Unless he wants to just get out of there. He's like, okay, I'll come for the picture. I'll come for a drink and then I want to get out of here.
Yeah. You
know? He's like, why is that nutcase in the front?
He took a quick surveillance of the room to see who was there. And he's like, I don't think I want to stay.
Okay, we will post the image of the cover, as well as some additional pages from each of the stories in our Family Portrait Gallery on the network's website. Paul, remind our listeners where that is.
Sean, that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let's jump into that first story, Sean.
The first story is Assault on Olympus, starring Batman. It's 16 pages, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Don Newton, inked by Dan Adkins, and it was later reprinted in Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover 2012. Batman in Assault on Olympus. You don't tug on Superman's cape, and you don't mess around with Batman's bat signal. Batman is out for a nice midnight drive around Gotham when he sees a gross mockery of the bat signal blazing in the sky. Going to investigate, his Batmobile proves it is nothing like Billy Batson, because when it gets hit by lightning, it's blown up, which causes part of the car to hit a little kid, Jimmy. We then find out that the quote-unquote lightning bolt Maxie Zeus sent wasn't meant to kill the Batman. No. It's just a challenge to him. We then find out that he used to be a college professor who is fascinated by an ancient culture. So Maxie Zeus is really just King Tut from Batman 66. By the way, that is not my observation. I read that somewhere and actually might have read that in the comments section of our own podcast, but my memory's so horrible, I can't remember. So if it is one of our listeners, congratulations. Meanwhile, Batman and Alfred are hanging out on the balcony of the Wayne Building, where Batman is unveiling his new bat hang glider. He's using this because the Whirly Bat would make too much noise, and because he has a contract with Kenner to uphold. After roughing up some watchmen, no, not those ones, he Kool-Aid mans his way through a window and tussles with two henchmen, one of which is wearing the greatest pair of pants that I have ever seen in any issue of Detective Comics or GQ Magazine. Then, the best and worst part of the tale starts. The ceiling starts to lower, the walls collapse, and a spinning chain blade appears on one side, and three wolves appear on the other end. Maxie pops his head in to make sure that Bruce did his mythology homework and can explain his work, and then we skip ahead to him escaping. But he's not out of the woods yet, because Maxie provided a backup plan just in case Batman escaped. Batman faces Jeremy Renner Jr., but defeats him by kicking him in the face. Our favorite Rockette is wiped out from all of the physical exertion and really gets to take it easy for the rest of the story. Using Maxie's pride against him, Batman goads the dummy deity into a face-to-face meeting where Maxie is too good to throw hands at the Caped Crusader and basically gives up. Brett, what did you think of the story?
I love the story. I thought it was great. I'm a big fan of Don Newton. I always thought he was really good at distinguishing characters. Even all the thugs are different shapes and sizes and dress. Yeah, it's great. Absolutely. This is also one of my favorite Batmobiles. I know it's kind of simple, but it's just kind of a sleek looking convertible. Still has the twin bubble windows like the 60s car. He can fight crime or he can just cruise for chicks in this thing. I mean, either way. And it has one of my favorite tropes from the 70s and 80s comics, and that's being stunned. This child gets a chunk of debris that just knocks him out, and Batman just said, just kind of grabs him by the arm, shakes him around a little bit. He's fine. He's just stunned, whatever that means.
Rub some dirt in it and walk it off.
Now it's blunt force trauma. Then it was just, just walk it off. You'll be fine. I'll tell you, this is probably not a popular opinion, but I will take the bat hang glider over the Whirly Bat any day. I love the bat hang glider. However, this one is a little more low tech. I don't like the little seat where his kind of feet dangle like he's on a ski slope. I didn't really like that part. Batman should be the same angle as the bat hang glider. And Danny O'Neill's not afraid to kill some animals. We know that. Sean, it's just a comic book. No wolves were hurt.
No actual wolves were hurt in the production of this comic book.
But at first, the whole ceiling's coming down on him. And then you see the sides. Literally, he's holding up an entire ceiling, which they say weighs about, a ton, I think they said?
Yeah, he does say he'll only be able to hold it up for a minute. Yeah.
Well, that's a minute longer than he should probably be able to hold it up.
Fair enough.
But then they kind of show the scenes where the wolves are on kind of one side of it, and then the ceiling doesn't go down the whole side of the wall, so couldn't you sort of move over? I'm a little unclear on that part.
Yeah.
But overall, it's a fun story. Maxie Zeus, I think, is a great villain, and I think he translates well to the modern comics because at this point, he's basically just a rich jerk who thinks he's a god now. So, I think he's a good villain. I thought it was a great story. You don't want to see the wolves get killed. But besides that, I think it was a really good story.
How about you, Paul?
I enjoyed it tremendously. I have to say I like Maxie Zeus too. I have to apologize. I missed that last issue was his first appearance. I said it was one of his earliest appearances. I just knew that, but it didn't occur to me that that was in fact his first appearance last issue. And listeners, let us know that in the comments that you'll hear later. But yeah, I agree with you, Brad. He fits in well with the Batman's villains because he's crazy and he's got a theme and he sticks to it. Sean likes that. The one thing that wasn't clear to me, I even went back and read the prior story. I was like, Batman gives him a lot of credit for being a master strategist. It's sort of Danny O'Neill trying to get us to think Maxie Zeus is really something special. Because I'm like, when did he really show that he was a master strategist, right? He was going to gas out a whole building last issue. So, I mean, okay, an interesting plan, but that was a little bit of a stretch to me. You would think somebody to be a master strategist, they'd have to win something at some point. But overall, great. How about you, Sean?
I do like the story a lot. It's almost, you hear like it's greater than the sum of its parts. I actually think the parts are greater than the sum of the story, if that makes sense. A couple of things, and I'm not going to go beat by beat. I think I did a great job with a recap for that. The thing I think is funny, so the front page, you see this quote unquote gross mockery of the bat signal. I don't know. I don't think it's just like a...
It looks like a jack-o'-lantern.
It's like a jack-o'-lantern, yeah. I don't know that it's really like a gross... Even like a Ghostbusters Red Cross off would be more of a... I don't think this is a gross mockery of the bat signal. Now, my next part, Maxie Zeus. This is exactly what I want Maxie Zeus to be. Really, really delusional.
Yeah.
I and millions of other people love Batman the Animated Series, and it really is the high bar, I think, for Batman. I think it's the best Batman ever. And there are very, very few things that Batman the Animated Series did not do well. But for me, their Maxie Zeus, I don't like it when he's jacked and buff and looks like a Greek god. I like it here where he's some schlubby guy who thinks he's a god. That makes more sense to me, being delusional and he sees himself that way. You know, if you get some Gaston looking guy, right there, you are halfway there. There's a reason why Chris Hemsworth is Thor. You get a god like that.
It's kind of like us schlubby guys thinking we're podcasters.
I thought for sure someone's going to say it's like Sean thinking he's a singer. That's exactly what this is like. The other thing, and I don't know that it's the 70s moment, but those pants, man, oh, yeah. I love
wow, the pants yeah. are something else. And the belt buckle that goes along with it, it's like a Dr. Fate Ankh.
Yeah, it's like I know what high-waisted pants are, but man, his pants go above his belt by like 3 or 4 inches.
Thugs of the year by far. Those
well,
two.
I mean, the guy next to him is doing pretty well too with his V-neck.
The receding hairline, the huge mutton chops. It's fantastic. These guys are great. I hope they're used again somewhere along the line because these guys are great.
I do love death traps. And probably at this point, we weren't really getting death traps a lot. Like Brett was saying, at first you think the entire ceiling is coming up, but then even then you would have to have room for the spinning blade things. I actually think they do show a better job when you see it's kind of not the entire ceiling when you see it coming down. The wolves, I remember them being dogs. And so I guess I'm speciesist. Because
that the wolves are dead.
I'm all a right. little bit better with it being a wolf than a dog, I guess. And Bat Cousins, you'll have to help me out. I know there's some Batman story where I think it is a dog who's coming after him. And doesn't he put the cape over the dog? And then I don't know that he kills the dog or just knocks the dog out. But I remember
he kills a tiger or something at one point. The Ra's al Ghul story.
Like yeah, there's one. Some animals. Okay, like a tiger I don't think it's. I don't recall a dog. But
I don't remember a dog.
I think there's some story, and I was really hoping it wasn't earlier in Detective Comics or Batman Family that we already covered. One of our cousins would have said, Sean, you talked about it for 20 minutes.
I'm sure someone will let us know if that's the case.
I wanted to point out, cousins, you know I'm horrible with issue numbers. Whatever the Batman Family is with the white bat.
It's the one Brett was on.
Yeah, come on. Hey.
I remember you. I just don't remember the number.
Right, sure. I see.
So I think Batman is crawling out of the hole and he gets out. And he says it's a great villain who creates a trap just because he thinks it might be necessary. That reminded me of Odysseus. I did like that a lot. So I think that does kind of play into Maxi Zeus being a master planner. Because even after this, he did create even another backup plan to foil Batman. So I do think that plays a little bit into him being a master tactician.
I think it's funny that the Archer guy, he's no contest for Batman. Other than the trap, there's no physical thing. But I really like the page layout in the art on 13. The archer shoots an arrow, it pins part of Batman's cape to the wall, and then Batman does a flip and does the Sean Myers kick to knock the guy right in the face.
And backing up just a little, we know I like battle damage, so you see that his cape is damaged.
Yep, his cape gets damaged, so there you go.
Now, on the next page, I do have a question. So story page 14, up in the corner, you see Batman, and then you see the transmitter tower.
Yep.
Is the black thing supposed to be the hang glider flying past the transmitter? What is that?
Well, that's where because remember, he jumps off the hang glider to go beat those guys up. So where's the hang glider going to go? It just goes sort of floated away.
So that's the hang glider. Okay.
Probably stunned those kids that were still lying over there.
No, I think I know what it is. It's Batman remembering seeing the tower when he was in that hang glider. So it's, I think, meant to be Batman in the hang glider, noticing the tower as he flies past.
Okay. As he does a flyby.
That's my guess. Yeah. Don Newton gets only an A- just because of that.
Yeah. I actually do like the resolution, even though there's no fight. I love that he plays on Maxie's vanity.
Oh, I love how Batman gets him to come back because he's otherwise, I'll never be able to find it. Really, Batman? Come on. You're giving this guy a lot of credit. He hasn't really done anything yet.
And earlier, he's on a level of Joker. Ra's al Ghul. That's what you said. I think that's Daniel.
Yeah, he says, hey, I hit the jackpot with Ra's al Ghul. Maybe I can do it again.
It is a great contrast for him, though. Like you said, he's sort of this delusional, schlubby guy who thinks he's a god, but he has to like climb into these bucket seats in a sedan to talk to him on the CB radio, you know, and then to get called a chicken and then show up. So it's great.
Anything else on this one, fellas? All right. Well, then. Let's move on to the Bat Timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month. As always, thank you to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. We are looking at the books that were published in March of 1979. And for the Bat books this month, Batman 312, which is the one with the fantastic Walt Simonson cover with Batman fighting off the revamped Calendar Man. This is the guy with the big horns, kind of looks like Loki. We get Simonson art inside too with a great story by Len Wein. That's just a great issue. Batman 312.
The next issue is Brave and the Bold, number 151. I have to thank Paul because I had no idea about this, but this is a Brave and the Bold issue with the Batman and the Flash. And already I was kind of interested because on the cover, it's the Flash with a cosmic treadmill. So I love that. But the title of this is Disco of Death. So I already promised my partner that after I record, we're going out for a walk, which would take about an hour. But I could tell you, as soon as I come back, I am reading the Disco of Death because I cannot wait. Now, I know right now I'm going to be disappointed, but I don't care because if it's Disco of Death, I need to be there.
A surprise, listeners, because our next Bat Family issue is Green Lantern number 117, where Green Lantern and Green Arrow are up against the villainy of Two-Face and the Joker. So that's also written by Denny O'Neill with art by Joe Staton. Also, the first appearance of Carrie Limbo. Remember her? She was Green Lantern's girlfriend for a while.
I want to give super props to Paul because those villains are not on the cover at all. If I were to just open up the newsstand feature and, you know, scour the cover of the books, I never would have realized that they are in.
I think it was because when I was looking at ones I wanted to include, you know, I always liked Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and this is early in Joe Staton's run. And when I clicked on it and looked at it, I'm like, Two-Face and Joker in there? Like you, I'm like, I got to go read that one now tonight.
All right, the next one is Justice League of America number 167 by Conway and last month's Bat Family History subject, Dick Dillon. Guest starring the Secret Society of Supervillains, and it is the infamous Brain Switch storyline. So this is really cool. If you haven't read this, definitely read it. I know maybe it has kind of lost some luster because of what has come of it. I don't think the story should be counted against the story that it was just because someone did something different with it like 20 years later.
Fair enough.
What is it that happened 20 years later?
Identity Crisis.
It ties into Identity
Crisis. Identity Crisis spins out of these events.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's everyone's favorite. I don't know why that would be a problem.
I will admit, when I was reading it, there were parts of Identity Crisis that I really, really liked.
Identity Crisis, and I'm going to be unpopular on the network, but it's a very well-written. I like Brad Meltzer as a writer. It's a well-written story. I just don't like what happens in the story,
but it is a good story.
I think it would have worked better almost like as a Watchmen type deal if they had done something like that.
Yeah, it should have been Elseworlds.
Exactly.
I agree with all that.
The part where Tim Drake running up the steps for like his death, like that really was like a movie, like pulse pounding.
Sure.
I agree. Absolutely. So that part I did.
So listeners, if this is our last episode of Batman Family, you write your comments to Rob. All right. While we still have the air, we'll go on to Super Friends number 21. This one has a great Ramona Freighton cover. And I was actually fortunate enough to cover this on For All Mankind with Rob. This is great. This is the one where the Super Friends are duplicated. On the cover, you've got two Supermans, two Wonder Womans battling each other. So that's always fun.
And no one wanted to duplicate the Wonder Twins. That's why. No. Sorry, I'd take a shot there.
I know that technically I like Brett. I met him in person. So technically, I know that I like him. But man, he's really trying to disprove that today.
Between that and the Batmite story, I don't know, Brett. Sean's not going to be your friend much.
I'm 100% right on that.
He's going to leave you to your own devices at the next
convention. I'll just be wandering around. I won't know where to go then.
Our next issue is World's Finest Comics, number 257. And of course, with World's Finest, it has like 18 different stories. Superman and Batman in The Innocent Who Hated, Black Lightning in Death Ransom, Green Arrow in Time Keeps on Killing. Oh, that's like time keeps on killing. Hawkman in Attack of the In-N-Out Invaders and Captain Marvel, Shazam, The Invincible Man. I have all of these Dollar Comics World's Finest, mostly for Captain Marvel, but I think all of them are great. I like all of them.
So Brett, tell us what you got.
All right. So I was listening to the previous episode and Captain Entropy went on for about an hour and a half with all this. So he set the precedent. So don't blame me for having a lot of stories here. Okay.
Have you never heard a runtime of one of our episodes? I don't understand why people are like shortening themselves.
All right. So Action Comics 496. Let me just say off the top. So I'm judging a lot of these books by their covers.
That's
what I'm doing.
It's okay.
And I'm a big fan of covers. And I think for a long time, especially in the aughts, that was sort of lost. It would just be pinups and stupid things. I think it's getting back to better covers now. And I really like that. But for a while, it was kind of a lost art. But at this time, there were some great covers. So Superman's basically pounding on Kandor like it's sea monkeys, which is great. So I just like that. Avengers 184, which I have, actually. It's John Byrne. So you gotta get that.
And I had that one, Brett, because it's got a Perez cover with Byrne inside, which is great. And they're fighting the Absorbing Man, who I always thought should be as powerful as Amazo, but he never was.
Yeah.
He never lived up to being an interesting villain. Wasn't he on the first or second episode of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
They sort of scaled him way back and what he could do and everything like that in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah, no, he just always hung out with the Wrecking Crew and stuff like that, you know? Or
you would think his power is really good. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that one. So
no, I agree. Billy the Kid 129 for basically the opposite reason, because it's just a fascinatingly poorly constructed cover. Where
oh my God.
You can't see anybody's face or anything except the one guy who he's sort of punching from around the side. And it's just so bad that I had to definitely look that cover up. It's awful. Captain America 234, because he's mixing it up with Daredevil. That's always fun. DC Comics Presents 10, because Sergeant Rock. I've read that story. It's a great story. Defenders 72. I have a soft spot for the Defenders. I like them and the Invaders, because they always just had these nutty adventures that were sort of weird. You never knew who was on the team, who wasn't. It was kind of like a non-team team. I always like that. Fantastic Four 207, you got Spider-Man. Anytime Spider-Man stops by, you got to pick that up. Flash Gordon 23, just because that's such a cool cover.
Ooh, let me look at that one. Flash Gordon. That's one of these gold keys with a great cover.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Painted cover.
It's an amazing cover.
Flash and Warlord Moran stalk each other in a game of death. At least that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the ones I pick, you know, the words on the front don't make sense.
Gunfighters 53, because now that's a Western cover. See, Billy the Kid needs to learn from that cover. That's a good punch him out Western cover. Green Lantern 173. Green Arrow might be my favorite DC character of all, actually. I love Green Arrow, so I'll pick up anything with him. JLA 167, because it leads to something, you know, 20 years later, which was just a masterpiece and should be in all continuity that we just discussed, you know. Get some emails. Marvel Super Special 10, Star-Lord on the cover. That cover is awesome.
Very Star Wars-y.
Yeah, it's a really cool cover.
That's a magazine. That's...
Yeah. Marvel 2-in-1 52, because it guest stars Moon Knight, and that's Moon Knight. Marvel Team Up 82. I just like that. Rich Buckler, Bob, is it McLeod? Is that how you pronounce his last name? Yeah. That cover is, I just love the setup of that cover, the construction of the cover. I just think it's really cool. Micronauts 6, because we got our guy Michael Golden doing that. You can't go wrong with that. Superboy Legion 252. I have this. I collect all the Legion stuff. This is kind of at a point where it was going downhill a little bit. This is sort of towards the end of Superboy being with the Legion. You got State and Art that's okay, but I'd still pick it up. Superman 336. I just think that's a really cool cover with Thorn. Weird Western Tales 56, another awesome cover. World's Finest 257, love the dollar World's Finest comics. That's the one I specifically remember when they went back to like a regular sized issue, and I was so bummed out when they went from the dollar comics to a regular size. That just bummed me out. And X-Men 122, because again, John Byrne. And that's it. That's the captain's fault. Oh, and I would get all of those UK Star Wars books that are on there, because they just look insane. I would definitely get those.
Bat Cousins or Brett, or like, are they just the reprints of the Marvel Star Wars
I think they chopped up, because the British books were more anthologies. There has a whole division in Marvel UK, and they would insert like maybe a new title page or something. They would chop up an issue and run it over 2 or 3 weeks or something. I don't know exactly how it all worked, because I haven't seen a lot of them. I'm sure Martin can tell us about how they were actually organized. But I think most of that material was from the Star Wars comic book. But
yeah, they're supposedly reprints, and they might take from like two different series or something. They might have backups of something that's completely unrelated to. They just look like they're a lot of fun.
How about you, Sean? Got anything left on your list?
My pull list, Action Comics 496, exactly for the reason Brett said. I also wanted to talk about DC Comics Presents number 10, which is Superman and Sergeant Rock, because even though now I am buying all of the DC Comics Presents, I wasn't at the time. And technically, I am glad I didn't buy that issue, because it was reprinted in the year's best comic stories, DC's Best of Digest number 5. It's the first story. Yay!
Great story.
And this is great for a podcast, because I'm holding all this stuff up. My next pick is Hembeck, the best of Dateline, and then it's all like the comic book swear words, number 1 from Eclipse. Technically, I don't have this, but it is reprinted in the nearly complete Essential Hembeck Archives Omnibus, and I'm holding this up.
Wow, I have never seen that.
When they say books are like phone books, this Hembeck book is like that.
That literally is the size of a phone book.
Yeah, I tried to look at the page number, but there are no page numbers. So if you're going to get this, again, I'll repeat it because there's 1,400 words in the title. It's from Image, and it's the nearly complete Essential Hembeck Archives Omnibus. One thing, though, I am disappointed it did not have the DC Planet Hembeck cartoons that were like the 3-panel cartoons. So I was a little bit disappointed. I guess that's why they say it's nearly complete, but this is fantastic.
I've never even seen that, Sean. That's really cool, because I picked this too. I'd never seen this in the wild, but I always enjoyed the feature of Dateline Hembeck in the Comics Buyer's Guide, which I bought for many, many years. So I would love to get that, but I might have to search out that thing you've got. How long ago did you buy that?
So I have the Amazon receipt as my bookmark, and it was June 10th, 2009.
Yeah, okay, that's probably out of print. Interesting, I'll have to look for that.
Yeah, it's definitely well worth it. Okay, then I also have the Justice League story, and then skipping ahead, shooting my dreams into action, I have The Spider-Woman number 15. Now, I swear the Patreon that we have goes towards the show. It does not go for me going on eBay and seeing that a complete run of Spider-Woman is $300. And I'm not going to pay $300 for a complete run of Spider-Man, is what I'm saying on this recording. So there's that.
Yeah. Again, listeners, this is our last episode. Thank you for supporting the show.
No, I meant like I just might pay for it, which I don't want to pay for. No, I'm not using Patreon money for that. I think I'm using my own money, but I'm going to say I'm not using my own money. The last one is Walt Disney Showcase number 50.
I knew it.
And that's Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I do really like the movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks. It's not great. It's not fantastic. It's very fun. An interesting thing is most of the DVDs are the 2-hour version of Bedknobs and Broomsticks, but there's a 2-hour and 20-minute version that was released through Anchor Bay, not through Disney. But I do wonder if this book maybe has some of the things that were cut out of the regular version.
And that is the latest episode of Bedknobs and Broomsticks Reunion.
Paul, what do you
guys wiped me out? I had picked up Walt Disney Showcase for you, Sean. I had the Hembeck book, Spider-Man 193, with a cover by Bat Family member Al Milgrom. It started the big run-up to number 200 by Marv Wolfman, because after that is when he jumps ship to DC, and that's when we get the new Teen Titans. But that's about it. But I will say, our boy is back.
In a major way.
We have 16 Richie Rich books this month, in the month of March.
That's what I wanted to point out. Now, I don't think it's unusual in summer. Is this like an Easter thing? They would have Easter basket presents?
You are trying to apply logic to the world of Richie Rich, Sean, and you may be out of luck for that.
And actually, what I meant to count up the amount that Marvel published this month and the amount that DC published, because 16 might be coming close to...
Yeah, well, DC was down to like 20, low 20s a month, and Marvel was double that at the time. They were trying to flood the market. So yeah, fascinating. Whew. All right, you ready to move on, Sean?
Absolutely. Our next story is the Who is Floyd Fenderman Anyway contract, starring the Human Target. 9 pages written by Len Wein, penciled by Dick Giordano and inked by Dick Giordano. Christopher Chance, the human target in the Who is Floyd Fenderman Anyway contract. Our story begins with the ring of the phone and a warning to Christopher Chance, the human target. Don't try to help Floyd Fenderman. Chance has no idea who this man even is, but after a call to a law-breaking employee of the phone company, he has an address to visit. Seeing a tailor shop with customers who aren't bringing anything in or out of the shop is a good clue that something's going on. After name-dropping Fenderman inside the store and then sneaking around back, Chance is quote-unquote invited back inside, where after almost being shot, he presses one of the goons named Fats for info and gets it. Our scene switches to Government Center, where Christopher lets us know that Fenderman discovered that the tailor shop was just a front for a numbers operation and that he was going to go to the DA to report Fats. Fats sent a hitman to kill Fenderman on sight, and now Chance has to find both of them without knowing what either one looks like. What a blind date. While there, the human target notices a utility bucket swinging in a non-existent breeze and makes a daring tightrope walk to try to stop the assassin. He does, and at dinner that night, he finally meets Floyd Fenderman and promptly discusses the payment options for his contract. What did you guys think? How about you, Brett? We'll start with you.
I am a big fan of the human target. I think he's really cool. I know you guys were talking about him last episode. I really like the TV show that was, I don't know, it was 10, 15 years ago, something like that. I think he works best as a period piece in like the 60s and 70s, because I think you can really lean into that. That Tom King miniseries kind of did that. It didn't take place then, but it sort of had that style and look to it. And that's everyone's favorite rendition of the JLI too, right? I mean, that's everybody's favorite depiction of them. I think everybody would agree.
Oh man, we're going to get fired.
I'm just kidding. The guy's got a lot of confidence putting his knife-throwing target right in between two floor-to-ceiling giant windows, too.
Always with the real estate.
Yeah, always with the real estate. Well, you don't get a real sense of how big this place is, but I'm sure it's massive. But,
well, he's got two stories above the restaurant.
Right. Open floor plan. Okay.
Well, you know, but he's got money, so I kind of, I'm sure he charges pretty well. So,
Sean, do you think he has furniture that he can jump around on and do...
Got a good knife range. We know that. I love the use of the steam press. That's a great thing. Yeah. You know, he basically turns that guy's hand into a panini.
Yes.
And then the guy kind of shakes it off, too.
It's like getting shot in the shoulder.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Oh, just wing
me. Yeah, just rub it. It'll be better.
I'm stunned. So at the end, I don't know why he walked out on the tightrope. Why didn't he just throw a knife at the guy? I mean, he's clearly good with a knife. Just throw a knife at the guy and then it's over. You don't have to worry about it. And this is sort of a more artistic touch. I love the use or kind of lack of use of detail on the purple turtleneck. And Perez kind of did some of this in the early Teen Titans issues too, when Tangal was inking him. Sometimes it would be part of Robin's uniform or sometimes a cape or something like that, where he used a real lack of detail. And it just really made for a great contrast because you have the detail in his face and everything. And then it's a really clean shirt. And the only other thing I wanted to say is I hate turtlenecks. I can't wear them. I don't think I've worn one since I was 8 years old. They were always itchy and they're uncomfortable when it would get hot.
He makes it look good.
No, he kills it with the turtleneck. I can't wear him.
What did you think, Paul?
I love it. The art is really good. I love Dick Giordano solo. I really, really do. I like his disguises. And this is why Brett's saying it works as a period piece. He does the makeup and I love how he gets in a taxi. He's got one disguise and gets out. He's a different guy. And the taxi driver's like, oh, you're not the same guy. The fight in the laundry, like Brett said, was great. I love the sequence with the sniper. I thought it was exciting. Cute ending. So what more do you want? Good story all around. I liked it better than last issues. I don't know about you, Sean.
I do love this story. For the first time ever in my life, it dawned on me, Christopher Chance could be George Clooney. Kind of reminds me of George Clooney in this.
Sure. He could play him now, but he could play an older one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I love how action-oriented. This is not a detective story. At all whatsoever. Ever since Captain Entropy introduced the term fair play mystery to me, it has been like stuck in my head forever because like I'm judging everything now. Like, was that fair? Encyclopedia Brown is fair, but a lot of these are not fair whatsoever. And this is not a fair play mystery, but I just still love it. It got me thinking about the human target as I am wont to do. And the human target started off in Action Comics. And that makes total perfect sense because this is action. He goes out on the tightrope. That's exciting. His scuffle in the tailor shop. That's exciting. That's action packed.
But I think, Sean, to that point, they are burning off inventory of stories because of the implosion.
Right. Yeah.
And so they're putting things like the demon, I think, was planned to be here. Whether or not Human Target was ever really planned to be in Detective Comics, I don't know. I find doubtful. Yeah. People are complaining. We'll get the letter columns later about two Batman stories in one issue and things like that. But I think it's all because they're burning off the inventory. They're saving money before they commission new stories. I think that's why he's here, because he's only here a couple more episodes, right?
Yeah. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, 4.
4 total. So 2 more. He clearly was one of Dick Giordano's favorites, and he was rising in the company. So that's my pet theory. I don't know how true it is.
One thing that's interesting, particularly about this story. So not only that he doesn't know who Floyd Fenderman is, but the way it's told is different, because these Human Target stories always start off in the action.
Yeah.
And then there's a flashback to the person hiring Christopher Chance. Then it picks up from there. So obviously, because he doesn't know who that is, they didn't have that. So I'm going to be a little bit self-indulgent, because I hardly ever am.
I was going to say, why did you have to tell us that?
Because this is much more of an action story than a detective story. It did get me thinking about action adventure movies. You always hear action adventure movies, action adventure movies. I'm asking Bat Cousins, what is an example of an adventure movie? And are there any adventure movies that aren't action movies? Like, I understand action movies a lot of times could, like a Bruce Lee movie is an action movie, but it's not necessarily an adventure movie.
Okay.
But I don't know that I can think of an adventure movie that isn't, obviously Indiana Jones, like those are adventure movies, but they're also filled with action. Mm-hmm. So Bat Cousins, if you can think of anything that's an adventure movie that's not an action movie, I would be really interested.
I think it's kind of hard to think of movies nowadays that don't have action.
Yeah. Even comedies will have, because sci-fi fantasy is different, because like sci-fi is more like laser beams and spaceships, and then fantasy would be orcs and, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
All right. Anything else on this story?
I love the Human Target.
He's great. I'm in agreement. I'm a big fan of the Human Target too. I think he's cool.
It would make a nice trade paperback.
Yeah.
Bronze Age Tales of the Human Target. You know, they could have done that when the miniseries was coming out. That would have been a nice $20 trade paperback people would have picked up. Let's see. We're moving on to Batgirl in The Race Against Murder. And we have a new creative team. Jack C. Harris has taken over now from Bob Rozakis. And the new penciler is Bob Oxner, inked by Vince Coletta. And this has been reprinted in Batgirl, The Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 2. Batgirl in The Race Against Murder. Congress must be on a recess because the Domino Daredevil is back in Gotham. She is swimming towards GCPD HQ to visit her dad, who's working late, when, boom! A bomb has gone off right in the commissioner's office. Babs frantically swings in to find CG hurt, but alive. The ambulance takes him away as the police and Babs survey the scene. The private messenger who brought the letter bomb tells Babs that he picked it up at the post office, but the police find no postmark or return address on the reconstructed envelope. Lately, Babs has also received death threats due to her sponsorship of an anti-crime bill in Congress, so she's not sure whether this letter bomb was intended for her or her father. For some reason, Babs decides to go and question Ross Canton, who is the, quote, one man who has his crooked fingers in every racket and graft-grabbing politician in town, unquote. Shortly, Batgirl is acting more like Spider-Man, hanging upside down from a fire escape at Canton's house. Lo and behold, Canton is talking on the phone about finishing Gordon off. What an amazing coincidence, Babs thinks, as she crashes in and confronts Canton. He laughs her off, saying she's just too far away from the hospital to stop his plan now. Batgirl rushes across town, summoning just about every cop in Gotham to protect her pop. She gets there seemingly in time, as everything seems okay. But she notices that the nurse is wearing noisy bangle bracelets, and no self-respecting nurse would do that. She must be an assassin. Babs takes her out with a gurney. After she's caught, the fake nurse spills the beans that Canton directed her to kill the commish, but they had nothing to do with a letter bomb. So who made the first attempt on his life? While discussing this with her dad, Babs tells him that she's not sure whether to run for re-election because of the death threats she has received. But suddenly, Babs realizes that the messenger could not have picked up the letter at the post office since there was no stamp or postmark. Babs tracks down the fake messenger, who turns out to be an ex-con that Gordon sent up the river 20 years ago. Babs makes quick work of him and realizes Gordon's don't back down. She will continue to sponsor that anti-crime bill no matter what the risk is. The end. So what did you guys think of the Race Against Murder? Brett, let's start with you.
It's okay. I would say the first things first is Gordon has a gigantic office, which I have to appreciate. And for this tiny letter, it did some serious damage to the office. I mean, it destroyed everything. So,
but he was only just
he was
hurt.
Stunned. He was merely stunned. Yes, he was stunned. I mean, it really leads to all this stuff I've been harping on the last, I don't know, year about real estate. The unsung heroes of Gotham are really the architects in the city planners. I mean, they're just amazing. You want some office space? Maybe that's how they get people to live there. That makes sense.
That does make sense.
You might get gassed by the Joker, but if not, you've got a really sweet bed. You can live cheap and nicely. So there you go.
Sean, do you have any initial thoughts before we go through the few beats that we have?
So I do like this story. I guess now is as good a time as any to bring it up. So this is the cover feature.
Yep.
And I understand, especially because this book has two Batman stories. So you're going to separate the two Batman stories. Fine.
Yeah.
But then why wasn't this the next story? I think this story should have been second. But even then, it doesn't really have the, I guess, the gravitas that is promised on the cover. And again, comic book fans, people who read comic books know that stuff that's on the cover is not necessarily always going to be in the issue. It definitely felt the cover makes it feel more important than the story actually is. But I do, especially like the Batgirl like hanging outside the window for whatever reason. Like, I do think that's interesting and cool and how she flips in. I think that's cool. She's on her bat cycle, which is super cool.
Yep.
Like, she gets a lot of action. She gets a lot of action beats in the story, which is cool. So I do like it. It just doesn't feel as important as it should be based on the cover.
Yeah.
Although I don't know that's necessarily a knock, because I don't want to knock the story.
Yeah. The story, in my opinion, is okay. Jack C. Harris, in my opinion, is no Bob Ruzakis, but he wrote a lot of comic book stories over the years, and we're going to get to see a few of his over the next few months. I'd like the art a lot, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So I do think you're right, Brett. I mean, he opens the letter at the beginning, and you see the little trigger, I guess, when he rips open the envelope. So that's, although I'm sure Captain Entropy will tell us all about bombs in the comments, but I'm sure it's not realistic, but at least it's clear what's happening, right? So it's clear what's happening. The explosion is gigantic, right? You'd think if that explosion was that gigantic, Commissioner Gordon would be like in 72 pieces.
His glasses were knocked off.
Well, okay. His glasses were knocked. He can't find his glasses.
And again, he was stunned.
So he was stunned.
Yes.
The police do a very quick job of putting the envelope back together on the screen. You know,
I think it's funny too,
because it didn't damage the envelope at all.
It looks like it's framed, like commemorative. Commemorative.
Yes, it does.
So I think some of those aspects are a little silly. It's a little silly that she goes after this one guy who then happens to be saying, oh, let's take advantage of Commissioner Gordon being in the hospital. So that's a nice little twist, right? This guy wasn't the actual killer that was originally sent, but then he's trying to take advantage of it. But it's just a coincidence piled on top of another, you know, so it's a little weak. Two panels that I really like, the one on either side with kind of a dumb looking panel of her looking like she's falling to her death in the middle.
It does look like she's falling. Yeah.
And then she does some gymnastics. The one I really like is the upside down one at the bottom of the next page. That's a great shot. That's like a Spider-Man pose. I'm like, wait, did Ross Andrew draw this? No, no, he just drew the cover. I mean, you get another action shot of her jumping over the bridge that's opening up.
Yeah, there's a lot of action.
Good scenes.
She gets to jump, run, swing, and kick and everything. It's great. Yeah. I want to give credit where credit's due because I usually dump on it. Vince Coletta must have lost his eraser for this one because there's a lot of details, a lot of background. But the one thing about this, and I don't know, I can't put this on Coletta, is the pictures are framed really oddly. Page 4, top right, where she's on a motorcycle, kind of cuts off the top of her head.
Oh, yeah.
And then where she's going up to the fire escape, her feet are kind of cut off. And then her cape's cut off when she's hanging upside down. It's just a lot of these are sort of framed oddly.
Yeah.
But overall, I mean, I think the art's pretty good. And I think this is one of the better jobs I've seen Coletta do, so...
He liked it when he got to ink the women characters.
Women.
So I think that's good. The evil nurse, she's got a funny expression at the bottom of page 7. I think she's like, hey, you get out of here. This is a hospital. Clang, clang of her bracelets.
Yeah.
She's got a good right cross, too.
Yeah, she socked that girl.
One thing I like about this is it does remind me of the episode of Batman the Animated Series where Commissioner Gordon's in the hospital and Barbara Gordon, even before she becomes Batgirl, I forget what's coming through the window. I don't know if it's a bomb or whatever. Something's coming through the window and Barbara pulls the green thing across to protect him. So even before she was Batgirl, she's protecting her dad and smart thinking, and it takes place in a hospital. So I like that.
And so then she goes back and gets the guy. Great shot of her close up at the bottom of page 9. She's like, wait a minute. And then she gives him a little tease. She says, oh, tell me, do you always talk to yourself? And then this is the issue of the villains who can't really fight, I think.
And let me tell you, even I noticed how Cheesecake Batgirl is in that panel where...
Yeah.
So that's some strong signals.
Look, a little saucy up. To take out a...
She's saucy. She's that. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. Good word, Brad. She looks very saucy in that panel. And I think there's a reason for that. And that reason is Bob Oskner. You guys ready to move on to Bat Family history?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I did want to spend a little time on Bob Oskner, whose debut in Batman Family is this issue. My sources for this bio were a couple of great articles, one from Comic Book Resources, another from the 13th Dimension, written by Peter Bosch. The links are posted in the show notes, as always. Bob Oxner was born in 1916 in Paterson, New Jersey. He always had a casual interest in art and attended NYU. And while he was there, ostensibly studying for a career in law, he edited the New York University Humor magazine and met several artists who encouraged him to attend the Art Students League in New York City. After college, he briefly taught art and chemistry in high school, but he broke into comics pretty quickly, and he did a lot of early work for Timely, particularly on secondary characters in Marvel Mystery Comics in the early 1940s. He did a lot of a character called Terry Vance, who I'm not familiar with, but he also did a handful of Human Torch and Whizzer stories. His big break, though, came a couple years later as he drew the syndicated comic strip Miss Cairo Jones from 1945 to 1947. But when this feature folded in 47, Sheldon Mayer hired him at DC Comics. He moved from adventure strips to humor and teen-oriented strips like Leave It to Binky, which debuted in February 1948 and had a very long run. When DC took on publishing a lot of comics based on TV sitcoms, Oxner became one of the main artists in this genre. He drew Jerry Lewis strip all the way until it ended in 1970, both with and without Dean Martin. He drew Bob Hope, Dobie Gillis, Sergeant Bilko, Pat Boone, and for King Features, he drew the newspaper strip based on I Love Lucy. Of note for our DC fans, he also co-created Angel and the Ape in Showcase number 77 in 1968. Oxner was one of the top artists in the business when it came to drawing beautiful women. What made his beautiful women stand out is how emotive and playful his characters were. That sort of sexy but innocent quality was a mainstay of Oxner women. A quote from Alter Ego number 67 from 2007 from Bob himself, quote, "My women had Saturday night bodies and Sunday school faces." So an example of that is Jerry Lewis eventually became an extremely cartoonish book in the 60s. Oxner's drawing of love interests for Jerry were key aspects of the book. And it's funny, in the CBR article, if you look that up, they posted a bunch of pictures of covers. And there's beautiful women standing right next to a very stupid looking Jerry Lewis. It's really pretty funny. Perhaps the best regarded Oxner series was The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. That book was less cartoonish than Jerry Lewis, while it was inherently revolving around the many loves of Dobie Gillis, who were all, of course, beautiful women. Oxner's other work in comic strips included succeeding Gus Edson as a writer of Irwin Hansen's Dondi for a time beginning in 1965. I thought you'd like that, Sean.
Yeah.
When the demand for humor comics fell off by the 70s, Oxner turned to superhero comics. He started out doing Supergirl and some covers for Wonder Woman and Superman. He then took over the Shazam feature from C.C. Beck. So I think he was between C.C. Beck, Sean, and when Don Newton does it later. And the lighthearted nature of these stories were perfect for his style, and thus he drew the most adorable Mary Marvel. Again, in this one article, there are some really cute shots of Mary Marvel from the 70s run. In the late 70s and early 80s, he penciled the Lois Lane feature that's in Sean's next podcast project, Superman Family, as well as inking Carmine Infantino later on after Superman Family dropped in the daring new adventures of Supergirl. Finally, Oxner was a very talented inker, and that's mostly what he did until his retirement in 1986. He passed away in February 2007 at the ripe old age of 91. And according to Mike's Amazing World, he had 696 credits, over 8,100 pages of comic book art. That, of course, does not count any of his comic strip art. So a very robust career. And thanks for letting me talk about him for a while.
When Cousin Paul does his thesis on these artists, I will be looking at the artwork as he talks. Probably the two most famous Ochsner covers are the cover where Supergirl is crying and the kitten is like licking her hand. And what's the good of being a Supergirl helping everyone if I can't even get a date? And then the other one, which I love, is Supergirl holding Prez over the city about to drop him. And he's like, Supergirl, don't drop me. I have my orders, Prez.
Didn't he also do the Seraph backups in the Super Friends? Was that?
Yes.
Yeah, those are really good.
I should have mentioned that. All right, let's move on to the Robin story, Sean.
All right. The fourth story is The Return of the Flying Graysons, starring Robin. It's 12 pages. Jack C. Harris takes over the writing chores from Bob Rozakis. The penciler is Kurt Schaffenberger. The inker is Frank Chiamonte. It was later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020. Robin in The Return of the Flying Graysons. Our story begins with a fantastically dramatic splash page. Robin trapped on a burning circus aerialist platform with the bar too far out of his reach to make a jump. Baby cried the day the circus came to town. But Dick isn't. He's wondering if the same Haley Circus that he used to perform with his family, the Partridge family, the Flying Graysons, he doesn't get a lot of time to ponder it over because an escaped lion in the streets of New Carthage is looking for a Unispan to visit. Robin cagily cages the lion and meets a member of the Flying Graysons. No, not those ones. Named Linda Gray. No, not that one. She tells him that it's just a stage name, and then Mr. Haley runs up to Robin and is thrilled to be reunited. This causes Robin to have some memories of the day his parents died, and how the Batman took him in and gave him the chance to bring the protection racket who killed his parents to justice. Robin snaps back to the present to learn that a new family group is using the Flying Grayson's name for their high-flying act. We see a shadowy figure who calls Robin a meddler, which I think might be a tiny clue as to who the bad guy of the story will be. That night, Robin is touched when he hears Mr. Haley give the exact same, absolutely generic, no simpler way to introduce an act than how he does, introduction to the Flying Graysons. Linda almost falls to her death, but Robin swings up and rescues her. Robin asks what happened, and Mr. Greystone, her stepfather, says that he doesn't know. He thinks someone tampered with the trapeze so it wouldn't swing properly. Later that night, Robin inspects the trapeze and discovers that it's perfectly fine, certainly in a better state than he's going to be, because Mr. Greystone has set fire to the circus tent pole which holds the trapeze stand. Robin makes an impossible leap to a too-far-out-of-reach swing bar and incredibly makes it. Robin then stops Greystone using his feet, just like Batman did in the first story against Robin Hood. And then we find out that his plan was to get Mr. Haley to sell out to a big circus conglomerate. We see you, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. But, ha ha ha, the joke's on him, because for years, Mr. Haley has been getting anonymous checks, which Robin figures out to be coming from Daddy Big Bucks Wayne. Robin is on his way out when we find out that Mr. Haley recognizes that Grayson swing in Robin's acrobatic moves. And then in the last panel, Dick does his best Bruce Banner imitation as he ponders just how that trapeze bar made its way to save him. What did you think of it, Brett?
I thought it was a really sweet story. I like Kurt Schaffenberger. He's got a nice sort of 50s style. Everything's clean. It's easy to follow. I like it. It's nice. I thought Linda Gray would be a good rebound girlfriend for him, too. I don't know if she's in anything else. I mean, I know he's got the Titans are right on the horizon.
So he's got a year.
He's got a year?
Okay, he's got to play. He can play around for a year.
I think she'd be a nice follow-up. And the last panel is really cool. I like the silhouette of him walking by the circus with the papers flowing and everything. I think that's a very non-Schaffenberger type of picture, but I think it's pretty cool. And I like the fact that the ringmaster recognizes his moves and knows who he is, but just kind of keeps that to himself.
Yeah, that's a nice touch.
It probably checks up on him. I doubt this is the first time he's realized that. My guess is he's probably always kind of figured out who Robin was and just kind of kept that to himself, which is a nice touch.
I think it's a better writing effort by Jack C. Harris than the Batgirl story, but half of it's Robin's origin. I think it's funny at the beginning, Robin changes underneath a car. They have a lot of space underneath cars, I guess, in in the DC universe. I don't know. Kurt Schaffenberger, for me, his best work was on one of Sean's favorites, Mr. and Mrs. Superman. I do like that.
Superman family, absolutely.
After getting Don Newton on Robin and some other of the artists we've had, and Kurt Schaffenberger last issue or two has not been my favorite. I did enjoy the story. I think sweet was a good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I said this on an earlier episode. Back then, every few years, they would have to retell the origin because not everybody in the world knew all these origins from the media. So some kid out there, this was the first time they didn't know Robin's origin. And now they're like, wow, I never knew that. John?
I was going to save this until the end. All of those pages that went towards the Galileo solution, I wish they would have been redistributed to all of the other stories in this book.
Yeah.
In the Batgirl story, I think it would have served that well. And especially in this story, because we're introduced to the Flying Graysons. You know, the guy is the bad guy, like, right away. Like, it's not even...
There's no mystery there, right?
Not a mystery. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, her name is Linda Gray, so not the Dallas actress Gray, but the stepfather is Gray Stone.
Yeah. It's a little on the nose.
Is it just a mistake, or she adopted by the stepfather? I do think that's a mistake, especially with Linda Gray, the actress, being around this time. Mm-hmm. I think that's a mistake. In terms of Schaffenberger, at the time, I probably was just a little disappointed that Schaffenberger, even though I like his work, was doing Robin, because at the time, I think it was kind of too much like Super Friends, and I wanted Robin definitely to be like more of a teenager. And like you said, Don Newton doing it, and Don Newton has such weight.
Robin has... It seems like he's regressed.
And especially, like, I don't know that we're going to go page by page. When he's on top of the circus platform and the guy starting the fire below, those two panels, I think Robin looks like he's 8 years old.
Yeah, he's very young looking there. Yeah. I agree with you. But there's some good panels too, like story page 8 when he rescues the girl. I think that's a really nice panel.
That is a nice panel.
Oh, yeah. And of course, if I don't bring it up, Martin would. Story page 11. The middle panel, absolutely. You know, the birth of night, the birth of Nightwing right there, absolutely. Story-wise, though, too, I kind of have trouble with Haley agreeing to this other family taking on the Flying Grayson's name. He wouldn't notify Dick. Yeah. And I just think that's kind of...
Yeah.
Like, he knows it's Dick Grayson. I'm not saying he's well-known, but he's the son of a millionaire. Like,
He's Haley easy to find,
Haley could get in touch with him and say, hey, let me tell you, your dead family, we're using that name. I kind of think he could have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, I have been here. Names are Greystone and Gray. Ugh. That was my comment.
I guess I do have to be happy that they are named characters. The villain was named, so that is a point.
All right, that's one area where Jaxie Harris has it up on Bob. Okay, yes, I'll get you. Absolutely. I'll give you that.
I do have to point out, because I guess I am now famous for this, on story page 4, the vocal introduction that Mr. Haley gives to Flying Graysons, Dick makes such, he's like, oh, it's the exact same one. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, the Flying Graysons. It's not even like dashing Sean Grayson flying high above, wonderful Martha Grayson in her spectacular outfit, and the youngest member. It wasn't even something like that. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, the Flying Graysons. He makes such a big deal about that. But that actually wasn't what I was going to go on about. So on story page 4, you have Haley, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, may direct your attention to Hayatar.
You found another typo.
The I, may I direct your attention.
It dropped off. You're right. You found another typo. Sean, that's like 3 issues in a row. I'm very impressed.
Maybe he's just remembering that clown staring into his soul. that's terrifying.
And I also really like the panel with the lion where he's flipping out of the cage.
Yeah, that's good.
I think that's really cool. I like that a lot.
Listen, Kurt Schaffenberger is a good storyteller. It's very clear what's going on. His layouts are good. But again, it's lightweight. If Don Newton is meaty and substantive, he's very lightweight. I don't know what the right terms are.
If it was Don Newton, the lion would have jumped right into a spinning blade probably or something like that. So
now the most important part of the story, how did the bar make its way to Robin? I have 2 theories.
I know what you hope it would be.
I know, you know, I would hope,
you would hope it would be Dead Man.
But I have a backup. Yeah. So do you guys have any ideas?
Until you said that, I didn't really think much of it. Like, oh yeah, Sean, that's a good retcon. Have Dead Man do it. What's your other retcon?
I would love it to be Dead Man, but he really can't affect things physically. So I don't know that it could be. In my headcanon, it's the Phantom Stranger.
Oh, cool.
I just assumed it was sort of the spirit of his parents.
Oh,
I know that's no fun. I'm sorry.
I like mine better.
All right. Yeah, no, that's cool. Phantom Stranger. You got it.
Okay. We are going to move on to the next feature, which is the Batmail family. So we're going to be talking about the three letters that were in the inside back column of this issue. And as always, we are going to invite Darren Goodhart, Bruce Findlay, and Scott Gibson. And I appreciate that both of you have names that I can read. So first, we're going to start off with Darren Goodhart, who says, "The first Batman story, Ticket to Tragedy, truly showed that the Batman is the world's greatest detective. Denny O'Neil has once again showed us that he is the best Batman writer ever. He can make Batman appear more than human, but still fallible. Marshall Rogers' art is cartoonish, serious, cinematic, detailed, and just plain sensational. Rogers is also an excellent storyteller. Ladies and gentlemen, my pen name is Darren Goodhart."
It's a good letter. I think he said a lot of the things we agreed with that one. So I like how he suggested at the end to make Action Comics style of comic. Then you could put the Human Target there and it would fit right in.
I am surprised Action was not...
Action became Action Comics Weekly later.
Yeah, but I'm surprised at this time Action didn't become... I mean, it's the flagship title. And especially with the name Action, Superman sold better in the 70s then.
I guess by the 70s he still was, yeah. My favorite, though, was the next guy who said, "I withdraw my objections from having a Batman story in every issue. Now I object to having two Batman stories." That's like letter of the month for me. I love that.
Great.
Good on you, Bruce Findlay.
And I especially like Scott Gibson says, "I would like to request something. Rather than featuring two Batman stories per issue, or initiating non-Bat family stories, as I hear you are planning to do, the demon is by no stretch of the imagination a Batman family. How about starring the lesser used supporting players like Alfred, Batwoman, Jason Bard, Catwoman, Commissioner Gordon, and the Joker in solo rotating features?" Yeah,
That would be great. The answer to Bruce Finley talks about inventory stories, and so they're using stuff up before they commissioned the new stuff. But yeah, no, I agree with all that. All right, let's move on to that absolutely not part of the Batman family, the demon. In a 9-pager entitled Time Has No Secrets, written, of course, by Len Wein, with art once again by Steve Ditko. And the only place it's been reprinted is in that Steve Ditko Omnibus Volume 2. So we pick up the action where we left off last issue, as Baron Time, remember listeners, T-Y-M-E, confronts the nearly naked Jason Blood over the empty tomb of Merlin. He doesn't believe Jason's assertions that he has no idea why the tomb is empty. Jason tries to flee from his increasingly unstable nemesis, but he can't get far because Time uses his portals to catch up. He encases Jason in a shrinking magical web to get him to talk. Jason is about to be squeezed to death when the one-armed Inspector Stavik shows up with his mob of villagers and distracts Baron Time. Jason realizes that as much as he hates to do so, he has to summon his hellish alter ego.
"Gone, gone, O form of man, lies the demon Ultragon!"
The two foes grapple and Baron Time drops the Eternity Book. Inspector Stavik picks it up and advises the mob to stay back while the infernal fight continues. One person in the mob, the bloodthirsty man named Miklos, argues that they should attack them both now. The mob attacks and the demon briefly throws up a protective circle of flame. Time takes advantage of the distraction and portals out of there, leaving Etrigan to the mob. The mob begins to attack the demon, but Inspector Stavik stops them. He gives Etrigan the Eternity Book, tells him to leave their country, which the demon is more than happy to do. Miklos is not happy, though, as he sets off an explosive charge in the castle, trapping and presumably killing Baron Time, who has gone back inside to the tomb. Back in Gotham City, Etrigan returns the book to Mr. Beckerman, and we think the saga is over. But in the last panel, we see Baron Time emerge from the rubble, swearing vengeance on the demon. To be concluded next issue. Britt, your thoughts?
So I was never a big fan of later Ditko when I was young, but kind of rereading some of his stuff, he did a run on the Legion for a little while too.
Yeah, that wasn't very DC. Good.
No, yeah. It wasn't very good. I kind of like this.
Oh yeah, me too.
He definitely plays into his history with Doctor Strange with a lot of this stuff. And he's not taking shortcuts. The story flows, there's detail, there's action. I really like the simple design of the Sorcerer Shroud. I think that's just kind of a really cool thing. The way it just gets tighter and tighter. He does a really good, it's a really just simple depiction. It's color and black lines and that's it, but it works. And the stretching of his arm on the bottom of page four and stuff like that. It's really cool. I like the Inspector Slavik.
That's with Slavik. A T, Slavik. Yeah. And he was in the original Demon series, as was Miklos. Okay. Yeah. They were both in Demon number one. Yeah.
He looks like a nutcracker. I think that's kind of cool. I like
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yeah, very well. You know, it's coming out towards the holidays, guys.
Get your one-armed nutcracker now, everybody.
Or Drosselmeyer will fix that. Don't worry. He's amazingly level-headed for walking in on something like this, too.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, yeah, you can have the book back. You know,
just get out of town.
You don't have to be a dick about it. Give it back to you. Demon's kind of threatening him. It's like, it's yours. Take it. I will say the one thing about Ditko, though, is I wasn't crazy about his demon. It was a little inconsistent, especially page six. The different depictions of him look a little different each time. And on the last page, when he's sitting on the woman's desk, he looks sort of bizarre.
Yeah.
That page too. So he's a little inconsistent on that, but overall, you know, it's a pretty crazy story. I don't know why they are so afraid of the townspeople. You know, I mean, they're these superpower, you know, one's a sorcerer, the other guy's a demon, and they're like, hey, these guys look like they're causing trouble here. They have pitchforks.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. I'm not,
you know, I've been enjoying this story tremendously. You know, Len Wein really likes the story that he wrote, and I can see why. I think it's a fun story. It's using a lot of the Kirby concepts. It's got Michael Gold. Golden art. I mean, if he had illustrated all of it, it would be even more great. But I'm with you. There's a lot of Ditko stuff that I don't like, but this I think is terrific. It fits perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I'm a fan. How about you, Sean?
Yeah, for whatever reason, and I've said it before, like I've read Batman Family several times, and the most recent was 2020. This is the most I've enjoyed this story, even though I've read it several times.
That's because of the scintillating conversation you've been able to have about it.
Exactly.
Honestly, that could be it, knowing I'm going to talk about it. Even the Ditko art, especially when you compare with Golden, yes, I would rather have the glorious Golden.
Sure. Well, sure.
You know, I love the Spider-Man Ditko, and I like this a lot. I can't get over how cool the portals.
Yeah, the portals look great.
Portals are fantastic.
Yeah,
I do kind of agree with what Brett was saying about Demon being off model, and then especially the last page when he's on the desk.
Yeah, it looks bad in that.
Yeah, it's not great.
Also, there is such the sense of motion when he pushes over the pillar and he's running away, and then I love that constricting yellow cage. I think that's fantastic. And Bat Cousins, I'm going to ask you to do my homework for me. Isn't there like an Electro Woman and Dinah Girl that kind of has that same constricting thing? I think there's some Sid and Marty Croft show where it is like a cage, I think, that constricts like that. I love where it's coming down and in silhouette, you see him push his arm up and then he does the poem and then the demon appears. Yeah, and the demon appears in the same pose. I love that.
That's the foreshortening arm
that
Rob is fond of talking about.
And of course, I absolutely have to make a comment that I think it's hilarious when Jason says, I didn't realize I was outside in my wrestling togs. It's a speed up. It's not a singlet, and don't get me wrong, because singlets are fantastic, but it's not a singlet.
Yeah, no, you're in your underwear, man.
Yeah.
I have to tell you something here. So I went back to DC Universe and I looked at Demon number one, because I was Slavik and Miklos, were they both in Demon number? And they were both in Demon number one. And in Demon number one, Jason and I've forgotten the Mystic's name, they were wrestling in gear like that.
Oh, so forget Disco Doom of Death that I was going to read. I'm getting on the demon when I come back from my walk.
Well, I had said earlier on the show that the first 12 issues were on DC Universe, but if you click on the omnibus button, then the trade paperback, which has all 16, is actually on there as well. Okay. For our listeners to read those. But a lot of this stuff is in there. But the reason I was looking at this is because I went and I looked in the first installment of this story from two issues ago. The guy who gives the book back to Beckerman, it's the same name, white beard and mustache. But the first guy was a bookseller in that old creepy bookshop, remember?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this guy looks like a businessman with a secretary and everything. Is this his brother? I mean,
I'm wondering if it's his brother.
Because the other guy I thought was killed by that golem.
Right?
I thought the other guy was killed. No explanation there. And I don't know whether that got cut or what, but I thought that was a little odd. This does not look like the same guy. And it's not just the fact that it's a different artist. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah, and since this is a Ditko book, I'm imagining that book that the demon wanted so bad was probably Atlas Shrugged or something like that, or the Fountainhead.
The Ditko deep cut.
That's why the other guys, just take it. Just take it. You can have it, man. We don't want it.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, great story again. I hope it ends with a flourish next issue. All right, ready to move on to one of the unsolved cases of the Batman? Why it's unsolved, I don't know.
I don't care if we do. Spoiler alert, this might be the one time when our episodes clock in under 4 hours.
As the Brits would say, it's in our brief, Sean. We're covering all the stories here. This is Batman in the Galileo Solution, written, again, amazingly, by Denny O'Neill, one of the best Batman writers ever, and 8 pages with art, pretty good art, by John Kalnin, a former Bat Family History subject, and Frank McLaughlin is the inker. Playboy philanthropist Bruce Wayne and his trustworthy butler Alfred are present at the Wayne Foundation Labs for the opening of a special crate. According to the red shirt security guard Mike Dolly, it has arrived from the Italian Museum. Professor Higley clues Bruce and us in on what it is. Turns out there is a legend that Galileo invented the chemical formula for a universal solvent that can eat through anything. That sounds super safe. The formula is in the papers in this crate, but unfortunately, the records in the crate are in code and no one has been able to decipher it for the last 300 years. Bruce is intrigued and is about to check out the formula, saying, hey, I'm pretty good with codes, and Alfred lets him know, though, that he's running late and have to go. Oh well, Bruce says, it has waited 350 years to be cracked. It can wait a little longer. Oh, Bruce. The professor didn't wait. He has solved the code and constructed the solvent overnight, despite the 350 years of scientists who couldn't have done it in the past, and is holding the solvent in place with a magnetic field. But poor old Mike Dolly interrupts him and wants to check out that Italian papers, but the professor pushes him out of the way and into the solvent. There is not much left of poor old Mike when they find him the next day. Bruce realizes that the only place that they have a similar set of magnets is Gotham State University, so the Dark Knight detective goes there to check it out. By this time, the professor has gone a bit off the deep end and has developed some more solvent in the magnetic field. He tries to stop Batman, but Batman just acrobats out of the trap. The solvent escapes the field and just happens to dissolve Galileo's notes before it dissipates. The formula, which Batman somehow thinks would have been a boon to mankind, is lost forever. The end. So, Brett, what did you think of the Galileo Solution?
First of all, I got a couple lessons to be
learned. The subtitle for that was Exasperated Sigh.
This is a weird story, man.
Yeah, it really is. A couple lessons to be learned is, one, make copies.
And, you think nobody has photographed it in 350
years. Yeah. If you're going to trap Batman in something, don't give him a gymnastics bar inside it that he can just jump to.
And with no roof. I guess yeah. They took the roof off. And put it in Maxi Zeus's apartment.
Exactly. There you go. Yes. Yes, exactly. You double the death traps that way. It just seems like a page filler, more or less. And isn't this case solved, though?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. An unsolved case,
yeah,
I don't know. I think the only reason it's unsolved is that they lost the solution. That's the only thing I can think of. I mean, Batman's, if I'd only gotten and looked at it, I could have memorized it. No, you're not the one with a photographic memory. That's Babs.
Yeah. I still don't know why they couldn't put this guy in jail. I mean, they say lack of evidence.
Yeah, poor old Mike Dolly.
Yeah, I mean, he killed the guy. So his death just never goes avenged, I guess, right? So that guy just dies for nothing, and then he tries to kill Batman, and he's still not going to jail?
But he's tormented.
I guess he's tormented. Yeah, he is.
Sean, do you have anything you want to add? I have one interesting point that I'll add when you're done.
I think I know your point. So, incredibly, there are two things that I can say that are good about this story. First of all, I think this is a complete crap story, and I hate it, and I wish all of these pages were in this other stories. Anyway.
Let us know how you really feel.
I absolutely do love the fact that this is a universal solvent, but they specifically say it can be contained by a magnetic field. I do like that a lot. I really like that. The only other thing I like about this story is on the inside cover of the contents page, it says Unsolved Cases of the Batman, the Galileo Solution. And the next line is the last in a series of special mysteries. And I thank whoever you believe is up.
Paul Levitz wrote that. He's like, we've used up all the crap in our drawers. Now we have to pay people to make new stories.
Yeah. I don't know that I want to say I hate this story. Because hate's a really strong emotion, but man, it's just like, it's crap.
It's amazing to me Denny O'Neill wrote it. The two things that I would say about it, you mentioned one, which is the magnetic field, which is very interesting. How would Galileo have created such a strong magnetic field 350 years ago? They have these giant machines in these big laboratories. Galileo might have had two magnets, you know, so number one, that seems a little weird.
The Phantom Stranger is my guess.
This, I think, is Dick Grayson's parents.
Oh, okay, oh, this one is. Okay, all right, that makes sense. That makes more sense.
So I did look up, did Galileo actually write something like this? Galileo did write and publish a big paper in 1638, the year that they cite. You know, I didn't read that much of it, but it didn't see anything in there about a solvent. It was about a bunch of other, you know, Galileo cool stuff, but it wasn't anything about this. So I thought that was interesting that he took at least something that was real and tried to make something out of it.
Did you memorize it?
I hope you memorized it, because now it could be gone. The Galileo Solution is a cool title. It almost sounds like a Dan Brown book or something, you know. It's a cool title.
It sounds like an adventure book without any action.
I wish it was an adventure book without any sentences.
Oh, I think it's time to go dancing, guys. How about you?
Amen. That is the only thing that is going to lift me out of this dull stupor of that story. In this segment, we're going to take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout of the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We'll talk about the most 1970s moment in this issue from any of the stories. Brett and Paul, I'll be honest, I don't have a lot, and what I have is not great. Now, I'm not saying my things are as bad as the last story, but they're close.
I think in my whole issue, I have a bunch of little stuff. I have one really good one, but I'll get to it when we get to that.
I'm deferring to you for last.
Batman story, anything, guys?
I have a couple for the Batman story, if you don't have anything. One is kids climbing those towers, because clearly those kids were there to climb the towers. And I remember when I was younger, you'd always hear the boogeyman stories of like some kid got electrocuted or some kid fell.
This kid got hit by a piece of the Batmobile, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good one to tell.
He was just stunned, though.
He was stunned. I just always remember that. Those were always stories of the kids climbing.
It's pretty good.
And of course, I mean, we already discussed this, but the amazing styles of Maxi Zeus's thugs.
Yeah, the outfits.
The outfits are incredible. And the car CB radio. I thought that was...
There you go. That's a good one. I did not have that. That's good.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I didn't have any. So that's fantastic.
All right. Sean, how about Human Target?
I had two things in the Human Target. First one was easy. The cab ride was $4.65, which today would be $17.54. I live less than 5 minutes away from the Baltimore Washington Airport, and I looked it up, and that is $12 to get there. He wanted to go further away than I live from the WI. Now, probably the best thing I have for this entire segment is when Christopher Chance is doing his tightrope walk, the guy says, "Wow, what do you know? One of the great Wallace."
That's it. That's the one.
I did research, as loyal Bat Cousins know, means I looked on Google, and the very first thing that came up is what I'm going to read. The Great Walendas started in 1928, but then around 1940, they became the Flying Walendas. And the last stunt or spectacular that one of the Walendas did is from 2019.
Wow.
And a lot of it is tightrope walking over things that you shouldn't walk over. But it's an interesting Google read.
But listen, that's the one that I had. But the one part that makes it Gabriel's Horn is the fact that in 1978, there was a made for TV movie called The Great Walendas. That would have been only a few months prior to when this story was written.
Yeah.
It depicts the Axe comeback after a fatal accident involving several family members during a performance. And Walenda was then killed in a high wire accident just 30 days after the broadcast of the movie.
Yeah. I forget which one, but one of the women like landed on their face and broke every bone in her face. Yeah. It's a good Google read.
Where he died was Puerto Rico. He was attempting a walk between two towers of a 10-story hotel in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and a wire stretched 121 feet above the pavement. It was a result of high winds and a, quote, improperly secured wire. He lost his balance and fell to his death. Sorry, that's not funny.
You know, it is now.
But the movie, I think, is what makes it Gabriel's Horn, and I think that's the best part.
Yeah.
So that's all I have in Human Target. Anything else?
I had two regarding the wire. Those buckets, are those still in use? Those the bucket like that guy was in? Those seemed a little dated. I mean, I never see them anywhere. I'm in a fairly urban area, and I never see anything like that. You know, they always use the cranes and everything, but I never see buckets.
Yeah, I think that's probably. I think that's fair.
Knowledge. I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember seeing that. Right. It's pretty good.
And the candle over the wicker in the last page when he's at the restaurant.
The wine bottle candle. Yeah.
In the Italian restaurant.
Yeah. Italian restaurant.
Exactly. Very good. Yeah.
All right. How about in Batgirl?
The only two things. So bangle bracelets. And then when Batgirl talks about her belt radio.
That's a good one. Yeah. I had nothing there other than smoking and the messenger guy. I mean, there's still messengers today. So.
Yeah. I just had messenger in the uniform. I didn't know whether
the hat.
Wear those things anymore.
That's a good one.
That's all I had. Yeah.
Robin?
Mine were that there are still animals in the circus.
Circus. Yeah. General the circus. The only other thing I had is Greystone's hair and mustache.
Oh, I don't know. That's probably making a comeback now. In the manner that this is, the fact that he gets a monthly check from Bruce.
Physical check. That's excellent.
Yeah. No,
excellent.
Nice.
I like that.
Because there are still physical checks that are cut, but for the most part, it's now all direct deposit.
That's good. That's good. I had nothing once again in the demon story for the third demon in a row. I have yet to find a Gabriel's Horn moment.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Well, it looks a little dated to begin with, almost, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of it's happening in this Eastern European country.
Right, yeah.
You have the secretary call box, the big call box on the last page.
Yeah.
So it's kind of...
Good. It's like the only Brett, thing you're good at this.
Yeah.
And then in Batman, I only had the tape machine that he's recording into for Alfred.
That's what I had. Yeah.
The green double-breasted suit. You don't see too many of those anymore.
No. All right. I think that about wraps it up, guys. We want to once again thank our special guest, Brett Young, for stopping by the reunion. Brett, do you want to remind folks how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. I'm a web designer, graphic designer. My company is Imagine 8 Design. So I'm at imagine8design.com. I'm on Instagram at Imagine 8 Design. I'm on Blue Sky at Imagine 8 Design. I also have a TeePublic account, sell shirts and stuff like that. I wore one at the convention. I got a couple nice compliments about it. That is at tpublic.com. You can just search for the stuff, but if you just do tpublic.com/user/cooljeep, that's my storefront. Good for the holidays. You know, with the holidays coming up, you need an easy gift. They're always doing sales. So even if you don't want one of mine, it's all independent artists. It's a great way to support artists.
There is a Fire and Water TeePublic. I'm actually wearing a Fire and Water shirt right now. So there is
that. Okay, great. I am working on a Batman family shirt. Should be available by the time this is out in December.
Wow.
But anyway, I'll let you guys know when it's up there.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. Okay. We'll definitely pip it.
Yeah. Please.
All right. Well, we're going to pay a podcast promo. And when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
This is the Batman family. I'm Batman.
Welcome back. First, I want to acknowledge our special guest voiceover artist, Brett's 7-year-old son. We got to say hi to both of Brett's kids over Zoom before we recorded. And afterwards, his younger son recorded the Etrigan and the I'm Batman sound bits. He loves both Batman and Etrigan, so he's in the right family. And Brett must be doing something right. Thanks, fellas. So now we're going to read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 483, The Curse of Crime Alley. Once again, we have a ton of comments, so we will be editing and summarizing a few of them. First up, Rob McCarthy said he didn't think Sean's singing was so bad. Okay, Rob, whatever you said. And then Bucky749 added how he was eating grilled cheese sandwiches and watching Batman 66. And then, spurred on by the scene of Bruce lifting weights with no shirt on, Lizanne Oswalt started a long thread about weightlifting with a response from Captain Entropy and a post from our bat nephew Isamu with the picture of said workout. All you guys who are into weightlifting, check out the comments and videos that Lizanne posted.
Lizanne then goes on to provide her regular comments. Impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover looks cool. I like how they copied the same movement of Batman and Joe Chill. I read the first story, but not this follow-up with Maxi Zeus. Hey, if Bats can hide his bat mask under his human mask, then the human target can change height. It's a fine story. Yeah, it's not an Agatha Christie fair play mystery, but good enough. Ah, nice butt shots of Babs in the next story. Yeah, the monument is way bigger than it's shown here. I had no idea what the clue was. I thought it was 1601, not 16th president to the first. The military guy was cool. Glad he and Bab dates till she got back with her one true pair, Dick. Now onto the next story. Ah, look, the card queen is Miss Beulah Dent. Shocking in the not at all sort of way. Well, yeah, of course the chin was fake. It was like the fake nose she wore as Penguin's daughter. Yeah, that punch is dumb. It looks more like a double axe handle upper punch like Kirk did. Sadly, no double drop kick after, or hand push of doom. Shatner even pointed out on YouTube how goofy these moves were, at least a drop kick. The next story. Sorry, folks, I'm not a Dylan fan. Still, his work is impressive. Geez, Dylan had no idea what was on the next page? I realize he's doing this with full scripts, but oy. Well, I have to respect Dylan then, since he was a good storyteller with his artwork. Can't wait until the next podcast.
Next up is network co-founder and all-star and host of the soon-to-be-concluded For All Mankind, Rob Kelly, who writes, great to hear the captain on another network show. As Paul mentioned, yes, Jim Aparo was a master at rendering a nuclear-level punch, but Newton is no slouch either. People's teeth often seem to get crunched out of their heads. The shaking Giordano art combo on the human target is really, really sharp. Not that that is a surprise. The demon is such an odd choice for Batman family. Like Red Tornado in a few issues, I wonder if these weren't inventory stories that had to run somewhere. Although it wasn't unexpected a dollar book by this time, too. You know, I don't know about unexpected for the demon, but as Isamu pointed out, there was also the demon mock-up for Batman Family number 20. So, I don't know, Rob.
I'm actually more forgiving of demon being in Batman Family because he did guest with Man-Bat.
And he lives in Gotham City.
Right. And we'll get into it a little bit later. Human Target, he is a detective. So technically, because this is Detective Comics now, so I'm a little bit even okay with him being it. Although it is, like we talked about it, he is more action than detective.
Back to Rob now. Dick Dillon's artistic output was simply staggering. There were months where he was drawing Justice League, World's Finest, and Blackhawk all at the same time. And then he died at 52. Coincidence? We think not, Rob. Related, as much as I love George Perez, especially his work on Justice League, Dillon and McLachlan will always be the look of classic JLA to me. I was lucky enough to meet Mr. McLachlan at a con and got him to sign a copy of Justice League 161. Great episode as always. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob. Bat nephew Isamu Hideki Yukinori says, fun show, gentlemen. I would be remiss if I did not mention that my dad and Batgirl herself covered A Date with Batgirl on episode 8 of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show. And then he was cool enough to provide a link to the episode. They went into more detail of that story than you would probably want, but none of the details Uncle Captain dropped at Gabriel's horn. So thanks for that, Uncle Captain. And Batgirl herself had things to say about those shots of her backside. Dad also talked about the time he bought my mom a corsage on one of their dates in the 2000s. So I guess it may still be a thing. I didn't go to senior prom, so I can't tell you. This is Sean speaking. Yeah, I kind of think corsage is more of a prom thing than a date thing, but I'm not exactly sure. Isamu, we should have noted that about the podcast. Absolutely. Any listeners, definitely check out all of Zoom's podcasts because they are podcasting gold. They are so elaborate and fantastic to listen to. Like, he was phenomenal about that. Captain Entropy agrees with that, saying, Isamu, I loved every episode of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show, but the Batgirl episode was special. Stella's voice is now the voice of Batgirl in my head. You just inspired me to download it again and see what we missed. If you think we added anything at all to their coverage, I am honored. Thanks for the floral update. We bought corsages for proms in the 80s in Alabama. I didn't mention that because I thought maybe that was because time moves differently there.
Another network all-star, our pal and future and past guest, Chris Franklin, stopped by, added his 2 cents. Great episode, gents. Always a pleasure to hear the captain. This is actually the first appearance of Maxi Zeus. Yeah, I mentioned in the main part of this episode that I should have caught that. I'll have to turn in my Batman fan card. during the next episode of Nightcast, Chris. So anyway, I always find it funny that he was created by Danny O'Neill, considering he's essentially the comics version of the made-for-TV King Tut, treating Egyptian royalty with an Olympian god. But as evidenced by the final story, Denny could go silly when he wanted. I seem to recall reading Dick Giordano really liked the Human Target character and wanted to be the sole artist whenever the strip appeared, but he was often just too busy. I think he at least inked most of his earlier appearances. I remember him from a few of these Dollar Comics era detectives, but in a few years, Jerry Conway would rope him into actual Batman stories. In a lot of ways, Bob Oxner was the John Romita of DC Comics. He could draw superheroes, but man, he could draw some lovely ladies. But always in a very classy, clean way. I wish we'd see more of his Batgirl, since he's one of the definitive Supergirl artists. Did Len Wein know that Ditko was going to be drawing this Demon chapter? Seems like he was gearing it towards Ditko's strange talents. And am I the only one who wished Dula had remained Card Queen over Harlequin? I like the look way better. Dick is strong and Kirk Fu indeed. Thanks for the spotlight on the great Dick Dillon. One thing I always appreciated about his art was that he could adapt. His early JLA work was very Silver Age in keeping with what Mike Sikowski did before him. But once Neil Adams was injecting more modern stylings into other DC titles, Dillon absorbed a bit of that. Keeping up with the times made the JLA book feel like the center of the entire DCU. All excellent points, Chris, as usual. Thanks for bringing knowledge to the reunion. Captain Entropy made a quick comeback, and he said, I concur on the Card Queen, Chris. I'd have made a bigger deal about how good Kurt Schaffenberger made her look, but I was trying to not sound too irredeemable, I guess. To which Martin Gray said, I still say she's a lot like Lady Lunar.
Next up is the Bat DJ Matthew Davis, who brings his song choices to the reunion. I've been busy, so for this month's reunion, I brought some leftover Halloween candy. Who are these fun-sized bars for? The Atom? Okay, I may need to create a Spotify playlist for these earworms. Batman, You Belong to the City by Glenn Frey. So this is Sean speaking. I know that song. A fantastic story by Denny O'Neill. A great introduction to a new villain, Maxi Zeus. And a great quote about mercy and compassion. Did Mr. O'Neill borrow that from somewhere? It really should be considered one of the best quotes in comics. The Human Target. Westbound and Down by Jerry Reed from Smokey and the Bandit. Matthew, you made Chris Franklin very happy because I believe he loves those movies. Who's this guy? He's not in the Bat Fam or a Gothamite. He's a detective, so he and Batman have a professional link. A non-costumed private investigator added a bit of variety to the costumed heroes and love the old cord. Batgirl. Up Where We Belong by Jennifer Warnes and Joe Cocker. And of course I know that, and I will not sing it. Most of the time, we see military officers like Steve Trevor as a romantic interest for the superheroine, not so much the enlisted soldier. As the son of a career Army enlisted man, it was nice to see the sergeant and not the captain going out on a date with Batgirl. Crazy thing is, he was able to muster up the courage to ask out Batgirl, but would he have had the courage with Congresswoman Barbara Gordon? Heck, the fact that her father is the Gotham City Police Commissioner is intimidating enough.
That's a good question.
And Matthew and Captain Entropy have a bit more back and forth about military fashion, so check out that if you're inclined. Back to Matthew. Demon, Time by Pink Floyd. This is Sean. I don't know if I know that. Is that like Time Like a River? I don't know if that's that or not. Then he goes on to the Robin story, and his musical pick is a generic instrumental score that plays in an 80s teen movie whenever the lead beats the preppy, jock, frat boy antagonist, usually played by William Zabka or Ted McGinley. Let's see. Dula was the daughter of a villain who pretended to be the daughter of several other villains to become a hero and join a group of heroes, and now she's going undercover with a group of villains to pretend to be a villain who's pretending to be a hero so she can catch the villains. Got it. Now diagram that sentence.
My favorite sentence of this month.
Matthew, I'm about to give you the ultimate compliment I can give something. I wish I had written that. That is fantastic. Interesting choice to have Dick take down Dave Corby, also known as the Raven, and not Robin. It does close out things with Lori, since we never see her again. I wonder if she just transferred to Ivy University. She's gotta rethink how she picks men. The football star broke up with her because he got a boo-boo on his face, and then she dumps the ward of a billionaire in favor of the crooked jock. Bruce Wayne, musical selection, Down Under by Men at Work. And of course, I know that song. Well, this blows. This story isn't on the DC Universe finite, and this issue must have been one of the ones I sold several years ago while in between jobs. It obviously involved a kangaroo. Oh well, an excuse to include this song. Whenever my wife has MTV Classics on and the video for this song comes on, our miniature poodle Casey starts barking at the TV. At the time, my absolute favorite title was Justice League of America and was a fan of Dick Dillon's art. I still remember picking up issue 184 and saw a different artist and then reading in the letters column that he had passed away. The one bright spot is that his replacement was the person who would become my new favorite artist, George Perez. Rest in peace, Mr. Dillon, and thanks for the memories. Thanks, Matthew.
Next up, past and future guests, our bat cousin Martin Gray provides his comments. Thanks for inviting me to the Yuletide barbecue. I hope you like the Christmas Colin the Caterpillar cake. If not, there's always Ace the Bat Hound. Martin, I have to say this. I now understand that reference, Sean, because I recently watched a holiday special episode of the Great British Baking Show, or Bake Off, as Martin, I'm sure, would call it, where they made caterpillar cakes. I had never seen them before, but they were very cute. They were also very chocolatey and kind of reminded me of a big Twinkie.
Yay!
Back to Martin. How fab to hear the good Captain Entropy on the show and to answer the most important question of the day. Yes, Captain, I do love the Batman Family logo, and the loss of it after this issue is a shame. It's not like they ever brought back one of the many excellent classic Detective Comics logos. The original, for example, has never been bettered. I know it took up almost half the cover for a while in the 70s, but it looked amazing. See also Action Comics. Dick Giordano is definitely a top five Batman artist for me. Neil Adams' Caped Crusader isn't as good without him. What looks more like a classic Neil Adams Batman, a solo Adams piece or a solo Giordano? I'd argue the latter. As for the cover art itself, yep, it's great. Praise be his name. As for the cover story itself, the Newtkin Adkins art is, of course, tip-top. Leslie Tompkins was so much better as a frail old lady than a young super doctor. I don't even like that they brought her back. They should have let that classic story stand alone rather than keep going back to the crime alley well. An interesting thing here is Batman's line to Leslie when she asks if he'll ever tell her why he returns there every year on the same night. Okay, he should have said, "I will if you'll tell me why you have a man's Christian name." What he said was, "It helps me remember how I began and how I'll probably end." That's Denny near quoting himself from 457's There's No Hope in Crime Alley, as you noted, the inspiration for this tale. And that original quote was used by Mike W. Barr for the story title in Detective 574, My Beginning and My Probable End. That was the 47th anniversary issue with Leslie rewritten to be a doctor who, not being dim, knows Bruce is Batman. Good catch, Martin. Thanks.
And I'll pick up on the rest of Martin's comments now. I must say, you didn't talk nearly enough about comic books that came out that same month as this issue. Please, it should be at least 25 each. The captain used them all up, so we don't have any more to talk about. The Human Target has no business being here. He never even met Batman in The Brave and the Bold. Yeah, it often had great Giordano art, but I'm buying a superhero comic, not Danger Trail or Mr. District Attorney in 1956. Christopher Chance is very sniffy about chorus line dancers, but as Sean points out, being able to do a high kick is very useful in a fight, as has so often been demonstrated by Spanish crime fighter Juan Singular Sensation. I don't even know that we can count that as a dad joke. Martin goes on to say, "I'm going through this comic and losing my mind. It is such a dull issue. Where are the colorful villains? It's not like it's edited by Denny, who loved boring street-level stories. Thank goodness for Baron Time in The Demon, who at least lives in Gotham, despite being from Tamaran. No complaints from me about this being a tad Doctor Strange. And at least the Batgirl story had a fun level of invention to it, thanks to Bob Rozakis. It reminds me of the Silver Age Steve Trevor dates with Diana in the Wonder Woman comic. They were always getting interrupted. Mind, Steve whined more than Babs, pal. Steve whined more than anybody." As regards to that Robin story, nobody mentioned that Bob Rozakis was the secret colorist. And I'm never sorry to see Kurt Schaffenberger draw anything. How weird to hear from Dick Dillon's son, Richard, that he didn't think he had all the JLA characters down pat. For me, he was the consummate Justice League artist. I just love his work. Regarding the Batman kangaroo story, isn't Swagman a word in Waltzing Matilda? Do I like the kangaroo in the story title? I most definitely do.
Yay.
And I expect this issue is valuable as the story contains the first appearance of Bane. I'm not surprised. Kangaroo races are not a thing in real life. Those animals are not controllable. Anyone can whistle, but not anyone can wrangle a kangaroo. Horse racing is still a thing in the UK. Sadly, I live near a track myself. Of course, Bruce Wayne thinks kangaroo racing is okay. It's a wonder he didn't even stick a mask on the thing and ride it himself. Martin, I know the musical references in that paragraph. I audibly highlighted them. Thank you. I love all my Bat cousins equally. I will love you more equally if you put musical references in your comments. Thank you, Martin. I appreciated it.
Then Captain Entropy, who was the guest of that episode, has the last word with the following. Everyone, I'm guessing that Bat Cousin Martin is closing down this comments thread, so I'll say one more thing. I invite others to post and prove me wrong, of course. Bat Cousins Sean and Paul were very kind to let me come on and talk publicly about this issue that was so important to me. Little Cap Knee would be amazed. And they said yes right away, even though I think I'd never been on a podcast covering anything but MASH at the time. And I had a genuine blast talking with them. They're welcoming and hilarious. After all that fun with them, I got to have even more fun talking about the issue and every possible tangentially related topic with everyone who commented. Thank you all. I love this Bat family. Well, we were thrilled to have you on the episode, Captain. Now, please pick up the trash bags and take them to the dump on the way out, okay?
Thank you, Captain. Now, we will acknowledge our Bat family members who shared our podcast on social media. We appreciate the support from all of our online community. We appreciate Keith G. Baker, Tim Price the Podcrasher, Just Trying to Browse, The Voice of Paul. No, not that one. Prince Faza, Ward Hill Terry, Michael Thomas, Rodney Trainum, Dr. Pop Culture, Martin Gray, Steve Whitbread, Alistair James Dunbar, Tom Pinsonalt, Herschel Mimas, Magazines and Monsters, Mike Thomas, Chris Franklin, Max Romero, Terry O'Malley, Doug Game Master, Don Lindbergh, Clinton Robinson, and Brian Schufo. Brian, by the way, just today, I listened to the For All Mankind podcast, and it talked about Rob encouraged you to start your TV theme song podcast. I second that. I want to hear that podcast. And if I can be so bold, I want to guest on that podcast because I love TV theme songs. So if you're planning your podcast episodes and want it to be a super long bumper episode, have me on your show because I'll talk all the time about it. One thing I want to talk about is, you guys might know, we talk about Isamu Yukinori and his father, Zoom. Zoom has a fantastic book out called Does This Trade Dress Make Me Look Fat? P-H-A-T. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm holding it up. It looks like a DC Archive edition. It is so beautifully done. He did a ton of artwork for the line it is drawn. I cannot recommend this book enough. This book is absolutely beautiful. It's filled with such humor and great homages to classic Silver Age books. There's a lot of appreciation for the Green Lantern animated series. So if you're a fan of that, definitely get that. I believe there are still a few copies left. I sent an email the other day to see if there were any left. I'm reading now from the email. There are a few extra copies of the book left, and they do plan to print a second batch next year if there is enough demand. So you can get on the pre-order list if you can't get a copy. The price is $75 plus shipping. It is absolutely worth every single penny. This book is fantastic. Honestly, I'm only maybe a quarter of the way through, and already this book is absolutely worth it. One other thing I want to mention, this won't come with your copy, but I absolutely want to thank Isamu. Inside my book was a copy of the Man Bat application for the charter member of the DC Superstar Society. And I was told that Isamu made sure that that was in my copy. Isamu, I can't begin to tell you how much this means to me. This is really, really, I don't even want to say super special. I want to say it's bat special. This really means a lot to me, and I really appreciate it. Thank you for all of your comments. Thank you for doing a ton of research work that I won't do. You are very much appreciated in this Batman family.
Hear, hear.
Now, before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. We are not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount that you can give helps defray the cost. And I promise that none of the money will go towards me buying bangle bracelets and high-waisted purple pants. To find out how to go to Patreon, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts. And thanks.
All right, that'll do it for the feedback section and for episode 484. Once again, we want to thank our special guest, Brett Young, for appearing on this episode and his son for a couple of surprises. Thank you all for listening, and we hope you will join us next month.